it is crucial that there be a clear understanding of each concept that we are using. The orderly buildup and the shedding of the uterine lining leads to two potential cycles. The first is a medically defined menstrual cycle, and the other is the halakhically defined nidah cycle. While there's obviously overlap between the two, they are not synonymous. As was already mentioned in the sessions this morning, the halakhic status of nidah is obtained when a woman experiences uterine bleeding that is not caused by injury. Now, every word of this definition is important. Only uterine bleeding makes a woman nidah, not other genital area bleeding. If the bleeding can be proven to be from an injury, then she is most likely not nidah. On the other hand, if there is shedding of the uterine lining that is even not due to menstruation, such as that can happen from withdrawal bleeding from medications such as hormones or from uterine bleeding during pregnancy, this in fact does render a woman nidah, even though they are clearly not menstruating. Let us first review of these two cycles, the medical cycle. In all medical textbooks, this is depicted as an orderly 28-day cycle. In the first half, the follicle, those cells of the ovary that surround the egg cell or the ovum develops. For this reason, it is called the follicular phase. Mid-cycle, on day number 14, the ovum of the most developed or dominant follicle burst out of the ovary into the abdominal cavity. This is a process that is known as ovulation. This ovum is swept by the ends of the fallopian tube where, if it finds a sperm waiting for it, approximately 20% of the time, a pregnancy will result. With ovulation, the cells that had surrounded the ovum remain as a yellow body, or as it's called in Latin, a corpus luteum, and this is what gives the second half of the cycle its name as the luteal phase. The corpus luteum secretes progesterone that maintains the uterine lining for the second half of the cycle. If conception does not take place, the corpus luteum dies, the progesterone levels go down, and the uterine lining is shed. In books, this looks so nice and simple. One of the things we are going to focus on in this session is how, in real life, it's generally not that simple. Okay, and now for what we need to understand the halakhic cycle. The halakhic cycle consists of the following steps, and we're going to go through each one to understand them in depth. The first is the onset of the nidah status, as we've already said. This is caused by uterine bleeding, not caused by injury. Then, the woman must assure that all bleeding has ceased. This is done by an internal self-examination known as a hefsek tahara. She has to continue to assure that bleeding has not resumed for several additional days through a series of self-exams that are known as bidikot. These 7 days that are known as the Shiv'ah Nekiim, or the 7 blood-free days, cannot begin until a minimum of days have gone by for reasons we are going to discuss. For most women, this means a minimum of 5 days. Now we're going to go through each of these steps on a step-by-step basis. Like I said, this may be basic, but understanding each step is going to be really important for understanding what comes up later. The source of nidah is in the Torah, Vayikra 15:19. It is also listed in Vayikra 19:18 as one of the arayot, as one of the forbidden sexual relations. The halachic status of the nidah by Torah law is described in the Torah Yoredeah 183 as follows. V'isha ki tiye zava, dami ye zova v'psara shivat yamim tiye b'nidata. ולמדו חכמים מבדרש הפסוקים שלא בכל מקום שתזוב ממן אדם טמאה, אלא דווקא דם הבא מן המקור. ולא כל דם הבא מן המקור טמא, אלא דווקא 5 מיני דמים. ואף באלו אינה טמאה, עד שתרגיש ביציאתו, ומיהו מי שתרגיש בו שנעקר ממנו ויצא לבית החיצון טמאה, אף על פי שלא יצא לחוץ. The key points of what I just said in Hebrew are that the nidah is only from uterine bleeding, which we've already mentioned a couple of times. It is only from 5 very specific colors, as we will discuss, And it begins from the point that the blood has exited the uterus into the vaginal canal, even if it has not yet exited the body. It is for this last reason that there is a need for these halachic internal self-examinations, such as the hefsek, tara, and bedikot, and it is not sufficient just to check underwear. She also needs to have hargasha, a concept we will discuss short. Okay, what I have said so far is by Torah law. As in all areas halacha, what we practice today has been modified by a series of rabbinic decrees. The ones most relevant to our topic, we will now discuss. One critical difference between Torah and current halacha is that by Torah law, a woman is nida only if she has hargasha, which I translate as a halachically relevant discussion. Okay? What this sensation is, however, even though it is so crucial to the differentiation between De'oraita and De'rabanan, is not so clearly defined. The main descriptions that are given are that her whole body shakes, she feels her uterus open, or that she feels a liquid flowing. Now, the post-pubertal women in this audience may be scratching their heads and thinking, I don't remember my whole body shaking. And don't worry, you are normal. Okay? These symptoms are apparently quite rare. I have yet to meet a woman who has experienced the first, her whole body shaking. I have met a handful of women who do claim that they feel the sensation when their uterus, feel their uterus opening at the onset of their period. I think, by the way, in the Torah Umada world, one of the things that we definitely need is a research institute, because these are answerable questions. I mean, it would be very nice to do a survey. One of my degrees is a master's in public health and epidemiology, and I would love to run such a study. But that's an aside. The third sensation is probably the most common. However, it is important to realize that halakhically we're talking about an internal flow. There's actually a debate among the poskim if this internal flow has to do with flow from the uterus to the vaginal canal or flow within the vaginal canal, but everyone agrees we're not talking about flowing externally, okay? Some women do experience this sensation, although generally in the heavier days of their flow, not at the onset. All this puts together means that hargasha does most likely exist even today, but it is rare. This means that many of the women are nida, especially if they are nida due to unexpected vaginal bleeding, are nida on a rabbinic level. A rabbinic level is no less important. Chicken nowadays is just as fleishig as meat. But it does leave some room for maneuvering halachically, as we're going to see later in our talk. Okay, it is important also to note that there are some situations in which we assume a woman has had a hargasha, even if she did not notice it. One of these is doing an internal examination, and it is for this reason that stains on a bedika cloth, that stains that are after doing a bedika, are judged by a higher standard than stains that are found on underwear or other garments. So to summarize, any stain today can make a woman nida by rabbinic decree, even in the absence of hargasha, with the caveat discussed before this morning, unless we know or we can guess or attribute it to a makah. What is very important, and we were going to discuss this in detail towards the end, is that this rabbinic decree has a number of built-in caveats. Okay, an additional difference between nida by Torah law and present halakha is the issue of colors. As we see here from this quote from the Gemara, by original Torah law, what would make a woman nida were black and four very specific shades of red. Okay, just look at the way, the detail in which these things are described. Okay? You don't have to write them down because we don't go by these today. I just want to give you a picture of how specific the shades of red were that would make a woman nida on a Torah level. The tradition of how to identify these specific shades was already starting to be lost in the time of the Talmud. In the absence of this tradition, one could make a very significant mistake by assuming a certain color made her nida, okay, thinking it was a nakud color, thinking it was a tameh color. One would start counting 7 days from that point, when in fact, she actually started later with the real color that made her nida, and thus she was using the mikveh too early, mi deoraita. And I'm stressing this point because, as we see later, there's been a fair amount of debate about why we keep nida the way we do today, and people have mentioned what I'll come to later and have not discussed this point, in which we are talking about a situation that could potentially lead to a woman going to the mikveh too early, mi deoraita. Okay. The other issue that has been a major change in terms of how nida was practiced based on Torah law and how it is based on today requires us to understand two concepts. One, the concept of nida. The other, the concept of azava. As outlined in the Torah, the rule of the nida was that she counted 7 days, starting with the day she first saw, and she would go to the mikveh the night that began this eighth day. In other words, she would finish 7 complete days and go to the mikveh that night. This would be the same whether she bled for 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, or even if she was bleeding up to 10 minutes before the sunset, but was able to get a good hefsek tara, she would go to the mikveh that night. Once again, Torah law, not how we do it today. Okay, escape. Oh, I can't even learn that. Go ahead. Rescue me. However, if she bled for longer, for 7 days, or she did not she bled at a time that she was not halachically expected to bleed, which is defined as any bleeding between day number 8 and day number 18 of this cycle, she had a different status, that of zava. As a zava, if she bled for 1 or only 2 consecutive days, she would wait 1 additional day, and then she could go to the mikveh. Actually, during daytime hours, she wouldn't necessarily have to wait to the night. If she bled for 3 consecutive days, she would have to wait 7 nikiyim. She would have to wait through 7 blood free, for 7 blood-free days. So why, now, do all women count 7 days? Because we have 2 problems we have to deal with. One is a problem that I mentioned before, that if you don't know how to tell the difference between blood that is tahor and blood that is tameh, and you start off with a tahor discharge, but think it's tameh and that she's nida, you're starting to count those 7 days too soon. And you could have a situation where the real day that she became nida was, say, day 3, but she thought it was day 1, and she'd go to the mikveh the night after day 7, and she would really only be up to approximately day 5, and she would be going to the mikveh totally at the wrong time, deoraita, with all its attendant prohibitions and the punishments of karet. And another possibility is, if she did not know exactly where she was standing in this halachic cycle, okay, is she within day 8 to 18, or is she between day 1 to 7, she may confuse whether she is a nida or a zava. Already in the times of the Talmud, as I mentioned, when the tradition was being lost, they started combining these two things, as outlined in the Rambam. Ubimei chachmei ha'gmara nistapek ha'davar ha'bei b'riyat ha'damim, v'nitzkalu ha'vestot. Lefi shelo ha'yakov b'kol ha'nashim lemnot yimei nida v'yimei ziva. Lefi chach echmiru chachamim b'davar ze, v'gazru sheyeh kol yimei ha'isha kimei zivata, that because of the potential confusions that I outlined in the previous slide, there was a series of gezerot, a series of decrees to say that at any bleeding, a woman should take upon herself the stringencies of zava, in that she needs 7 days, 7 additional days, the shiva nikiyim, and also the stringency of the nida, that she goes to the mikveh at night and she doesn't go to the mikveh during the day. Okay, this was actually a two-step process. The first step was the gezeira on the part of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, to deal with situations of the sadot, to deal with the situations when there weren't any Torah scholars around who would be able to tell the difference or answer questions. And his proposal was as follows. If she sees for one day, let her wait 6 more days. Okay, and then we've taken care of both possibilities, because if she was an Ida and she waited 6 days, then she's going at the right time. If she was a Zava and only bled one day, she only had to wait 1 more day, so she certainly took care of it. The same thing is true if she bled for 2 days, added 6 additional days. If she was Nida only on day 2, since she added 6 additional days, she wasn't going to the mikveh too early, because that would be day number 7 based on day number 2. And if she saw 3 consecutive days or more, then she should put in the Shiva Nekiyim, because then, you know, maybe this could be a situation of Zava Gedola, and she would need the Shiva Nekiyim. Because of the difficulty of keeping track, now when exactly am I supposed to do 6 and when exactly am I supposed to do 7, apparently B'not Yisrael, the women themselves, decided, the heck with it, let's just make everything 7 and make it uniform. I'm showing this progression, though, because there's a tendency of sometimes saying, oh, the Shiva Nekiyim were just a minhag on the part of women that added a whole nother 7 days, and that does not seem to be the tradition that we have in our sources. At most, they added 1 additional day in some circumstances. Okay, and the process actually was started because of a real halachic problem and started out with a takana of Rebbe. Once again, to stress how this is the halacha, this is how it's brought down in the Torah. Misherabu hagaliyot v'takfu hatzarot v'nitma'atu halevavot chashu shema yavo letot b'isur karet shema tira isha b'meni data shisha yamim v'yeh hakol dam tahor u'bashvi'i shema tira dam tamei v'savura letbol b'lel shmini v'tzricha od shiva nekiyim hechmiru letamei kol mare dam adom v'kedei shelo yavo'u let'ot ta'ut ben yimei nida v'yimei ziva הוסיפו חומרה אחרי חומרה, עד שאמרו שאפילו אם לא תראה אלא טיפת דם כחרדל, תשב עליה שבע נקיים כזווה גדולה. Okay, the Torah is basically saying, due to the 2 problems I outlined before, we have gotten through a series of the gezerot to the point that if a woman has any bleeding, that renders her nida, based on the definitions we talked about before, she waits shevah nekiyim as if she was a zavah gedola. One of the reasons I also put up this slide, though, is he says this is because of Rabu HaGaloyot v'takfu HaTzarot. This is not necessarily a good thing. This is an unfortunate outcome of being in Galut. And I point that out because this isn't so much an issue of halachic infertility, but is a little bit a matter of how we educate couples. There's a tendency sometimes to look at the fact that a woman goes to the mikvah on day 12 and at least in theory is supposed to ovulate on day 14 as showing how brilliant this system is because she's most likely to become pregnant. And I want you to realize that this is a bidi'evit situation, okay? And we should not be using... There are a lot of other reasons for keeping Hilchot Nida, but I don't think the increasing fertility should be one of the ones that we use. And perhaps in terms of sensitivities towards couples who will later be suffering from infertility specifically because of the halachot, having this presented to them back before they get married makes the situation even more painful. Okay, so we've gone through the halachic cycle, what makes the onset of the nidah status and how the nidah came to be together with the ziva and what we do today. The second step would be the cessation of all bleeding, which as I outlined before, the reason she needs to indicate that the bleeding has actually ceased by doing a hefsek tara is if she had bled internally and not externally, that alone would make her nidah. She was still bleeding, but it wasn't coming out. That could still make her nidah, and that is why one needs to do the hefsek tara, and that is why one continues the bedikot. Now, I've purposely skipped over for a second the minimum of 5 days, so we're coming back to that. We've also looked in great detail why we have these Shiva Nekiyim, why we have the 7 blood-free days. Now I'm going to get to, well, why do we have this 5-day minimum? And that's for another halachic concept, okay? A concept that is known as plitat shichrat zera, or the expulsion of semen. Halachically, if a woman would expel semen during the Shiva Nekiyim, during the days of counting, that day of the Shiva Nekiyim would not count, Okay? It's not like starting to bleed again and nidan, starting the whole process over again, but that specific day would not count. And since from a halachic point of view, semen is considered viable for 72 hours, we don't want to have a situation where she had relations within, in other words, that the Sheva Nekiyim could come out within 72 hours of having relations. Which if she was allowed to have relations, if she could start the Sheva Nekiyim immediately when bleeding ceased, then you could, and she only bled for a day or two, you could have a situation where the 72 hours came out during the Sheva Nekiyim, and to avoid that situation, we came up with a minimum of 4 days. Now, how did 72 hours get to 4 days? Because it's 72 complete hours. So a couple hours could be in one day, a couple hours could be on the fourth day, and you put them all together, you get 4 days. Question? Yes? Hold on 1 second.
I understand why these laws were enacted, and I understand the concepts of the 5 days instead of three, to make sure it's 3 complete days. But my question is, wouldn't the woman know if she had relations before, and why can't she determine for each cycle?
Hang on there, we'll get to that. Okay? Good question, I have an answer. Okay, so first of all, there was never an issue of 3 days, because unless she was having relations exactly at the moment that the day start and 72 hours later would be exactly the end of 3 days, which is not very hard, easy to figure out, especially when you also get to Bein HaShemashot and which day is it, it had to be 4 days. The question is then, why was the fifth day added? The Rama adds the additional day in case of the situation where she had relationships in that twilight zone, halachic twilight zone, between sunset and nightfall, and she would think it was one day and it was actually the next day, and she would miscount it. Now, after that, there were some additional gzeirot. Okay, and the additional gzeirot are that even if no relationships have taken place, it's called lo shimsha atu shimsha. Okay, in a situation where she did not have relations, we don't want to make a difference, we don't want to make things confusing, and we apply this minimum of 5 days, if you're Ashkenazi, to even a situation where no relations have taken place. And the gzeirah is to the point that even if relations couldn't have taken place, okay, if the husband and wife are in two different continents, okay, in most continents, this gzeirah will apply then as well. The only time it does not apply is if the couple is halachically forbidden for having relations, okay? So if, for example, she's forbidden for having relations for, it's one of her vestot, and it comes out exactly to it without any gap in between, she may be able to cut her day off that way. According to some opinions, if it works out right after Yom Kippur, or right after Tisha B'Av, where she's halachically forbidden to do it, there are also some who would say, let's say she made a mistake and she thought she became Nida a day or two earlier, and then actually became Nida later, but she thought, she wasn't having any relations because she was thinking Nida, you may be able to add those as well. Okay? And it's important to know that because this is going to be some of the maneuverability that we have later on. It's also important, though, to know that not every community around this world has adapted all of this gzeirot. Some Sephardic communities do go by 5 days, some Sephardic communities do go by 4 days, and some Sephardic communities do not have this idea of lo shimsha atu shimsha, and therefore, if the couple has not had relations, they don't see it as much of a problem. Rabbi Vadia Yosef also talks about the possibility of perhaps her being able to douche and use that as a thing. The development, okay, of the Shabbat. In Kuf Tzadi Vav, okay, all the with the Achronim and stuff like that, you just see it developing and developing. Okay, so to summarize, the earliest immersion is the night following 12 days for Ashkenazim and following 11 days for some Sephardim. Now let's go back to our idealized menstrual cycle. If she, in fact, goes to the mikveh on day 12, and she, in fact, ovulates on day 14, the situation is actually perfect because the sperm are going to be sitting there waiting for the egg to ovulate, which is the best way for conception to take place. Men are supposed to be polite and waiting for the woman to come in. That is the absolute best situation. However, as we're going to see, this doesn't happen a lot. Here is some data about how variable the menstrual cycle can be. I fully believe, actually, that the reason that they put 28 days in medical textbooks is to make it easier for us poor doctors, because it divides easily into 4 weeks. I'm a doctor, I can say that. However, if you look at the average length of the menstrual cycle, and I purposely pulled out some older data because this is dealing before when women were mostly having nice natural cycles and far less likely to be hormonally controlled than they are today, you see that the average length of the menstrual cycle is about 30 days in younger women, between 20 and 24. It slowly gets shorter over time. And only in maybe the 40 to 44-year-olds is it actually even approaching 28 days. This trend, though, is important for us to realize because it does mean that halachic infertility is more likely to be a problem among older women. Another study from, in this case, 1967 by Trialor et al. Shows similar data. Okay? He also comes up with an average of about 30 for women in their 20s. And even gets down to about 27 for women who, from age 40 and on. Now, this is a chart that was published in Israel back in the 1960s, okay, in the Israel Medical, the Hebrew Medical Journal or something. I have yet been able to find the entire article, even though I'm working on it. But this was reprinted on the Shari Tzedek on the Machon Schlesinger website. And this is a chart that starts to illustrate how halachic infertility can, in fact, take place. Okay, he talks about the woman immersing here on day number 12. If she has a 33-day cycle, these are her potentially fertile days. Okay, because let's say ovulation took a place about here. He's using a relatively long time for the ovum to be alive. We actually go by much shorter times today. She would be fertile here if relation took place earlier, and then she ovulated. But this is based on a number of assumptions. Okay, it's first of all based on the fact that all women are going to the mikvah on day number 12. It's also based on the fact that women are ovulating 14 days before their next menses, which once again is what it says in medical textbooks and is sort of the standard, but not really the reality. Okay, we need to be rescued again. Thanks. Okay, what we have here is a very, very important study for our purposes, which shows how real life is more complicated than not. This is a study back in 1977 by Bowman, in which he took women's length of the menstrual cycle, and based on their basal body temperature as an indication of ovulation, looked at what day they were actually ovulating. So we took women with a 19-day cycle, who, based on our saying that they will ovulate 14 days before their next menses, should in fact be ovulating around day 5, okay? And 100% of them should be having a tremendous problem of halachic infertility. But what he showed is, in fact, 51% had this early cycle, but 30% of them ovulated after day 15. Okay, and if you go down this entire list, between 20 and 23, 28%, less than day 11, very problematic halachically, as we've seen, but 27% after day 15, and certainly a number of other percentages that could easily be after mikvah. So what I learned from this chart is that it's not enough to know how long a woman's cycle is, and it's really important to measure when she's actually ovulating. One of the advances over the last, I guess it's about 10, 15 years, is that we've expanded our ability to actually measure ovulation. Basal body temperature has existed for many years, and what it basically does is if a woman takes her temperature before she gets out of the bed in the morning, having not gotten out of the bed for at least 4 consecutive hours, which is impossible for certain women, then she will be able to see that at a certain point in her cycle, there's at least a half a degree to a 1 degree difference in temperature, and it stays on average up. Okay, it'll look something like this. That shows that she already ovulated. Okay, so this is a useful test to know she ovulated yesterday. She has the potential of ovulating, but in terms of predicting when she's going to ovulate, in terms of knowing to have relations quickly because now we're going to ovulate, it's too late. By the time you have this information, she has already ovulated and will probably not get pregnant on that cycle, though maybe she'll make it in on the last thing. What we do have now today is the ability to measure various kits, they're sold in every single pharmacy, to measure the LH surge. What the LH surge is, that somewhere between 12 to 36 hours before ovulation takes place, one of those hormones from the pituitary, known as luteinizing hormone, takes a nice surge. You can measure that in a woman's urine, and in fact, what the tests are these strips that look exactly like the pregnancy test that women do also in their urine, same technology, where if she has a surge of LH, she'll see two stripes on that, and she knows then she's about to ovulate in the next 12 to 36 hours. They're reasonably accurate, okay? There's some difference between one and the other. Is it 12 hours, 24 hours? But it is a help. The only problem is a little bit the cost, okay? Each kit, which has five test strips in it, which is supposed to at least in theory be enough of a month, for a month, which if a woman knows more or less when she ovulates is true, but if she's clueless, she may need two kits or more. They cost about $20 to $30 per box that you're buying. Another way to be able to assess ovulation is actually to do an ultrasound. If you do an ultrasound and you see that the follicle is still there and the follicle is not yet burst and she has going to the mikveh tonight, okay, then her problem is not that she has missed the ovulation. In order to use this for timing, you would also need to do a series of them. And it's interesting because in Israel, they tend to do serial ultrasounds because women don't have to pay for the ultrasounds because they're covered by the national health insurance. Here in the States, where you're going to pay for every one of those ultrasounds, I think it actually comes out cheaper, and it certainly comes out easier to use the kits you get in the pharmacy. Okay, this is, by the way, on laparoscopy. I can't see it so well with the lights, but this is what the follicle looks like just before it's about to burst. Okay, another thing that exists for knowing if a woman is in general ovulating is when you measure her serum progesterone in the second half of the cycle. However, this tells you nothing as far as timing. It just shows that she has the possibility of ovulating. Okay, so some more data about when women are actually ovulating. This is a study done in 1970 by Lulenfeld and Burmaun of 512 women, 4,540 cycles. And they showed that 21% of the population ovulated less than day 12. Okay, problematic, halachic infertility. 48% of the women are 12 to 16 days. Some of them will actually still have problems because if she bled for more than 5 days, she may go to the mikveh after that. And about 31% are day 16 and on. Okay, so this gives us a frequency of halachic infertility of somewhere about a quarter of the women, at least in theory. But it is important to know that timing is not everything. Okay, for whatever reason, HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided it, conception is a very inefficient process. If a couple has relations absolutely positively at the right time of the month, only about 25% of them are going to get pregnant. And of those pregnancies, a certain percentage based on age are also not going to progress in pregnancies and end in miscarriage, often much earlier in the cycle that the woman doesn't even know she had a miscarriage. Sometimes her period was late by a day or two or something like that. So I'm stressing this point because, as we'll see, there's been a bit of a tararum recently about how much infertility, halachic infertility, is causing. I think it needs to be taken a little bit in perspective that it doesn't work all the time anyway, every single cycle. Okay, now, over the course of the last century, and I have to admit it sounds very funny to me to talk about the 1900s, it's the last century, but it is. There have been a number of halachic responses related to this mismatch between the time a woman is going to the mikveh and the time that she is actually able to conceive. The earliest one, at least that I was able to find, is actually by Rav Kook in 1933. This is from Dat Cohen. He was presented with a situation of pikuach nefesh, okay, where what they had told him was that the woman had some medical condition, that the only way to cure her was for her to become pregnant, and the reason she has not become pregnant is because she would have to have relations before the time that she went to the mikveh. He discussed the possibility about, can we do without the Sheva Nekiyim and go back to Torah law in this case of pikuach nefesh? He discusses it, and he, even though he says the Sheva Nekiyim are an issue of derabbanan, not deoraita, he rejects it. And in that particular, even in the case of pikuach nefesh, and in that particular situation, he gives an alternate proposal that the woman not have relations for 3 days before she expects to get her menses, and then in that situation, when she hasn't had relationships for at least 3 days, she can then start her Sheva Nekiyim immediately at the cessation of bleeding. Okay? What? It's assumed, yes, yes. So first of all, just on halachic level, what he's basically willing to do is not willing to get rid of the Sheva Nekiyim, but in this kind of situation, he is willing to say that at the time that they made the gezera of lo shimsha atu shimsha, they didn't have a situation of pikuach nefesh in mind. It doesn't apply there, and we can let her go immediately. But practically, it would only help if her period was short. A similar approach is taken by Rav Moshe Feinstein in the source listed here, where his practical solution, also in a situation of a woman who was having difficulty conceiving during to the timing, was in fact that she should not have relations for 3 days before she expected her period, and then she could start the Sheva Nekiyim immediately afterwards. In that way, we could at least in theory get her to the mikveh on day number 9, day number 10, something of the sort, if she had a short period. Not everybody felt it was that simple. The Hartzvi, Rav Tziv Pesach Frank, and the Tzitz Eliezer say that if we want to apply this business of her being able to start the Sheva Nekiyim immediately after the cessation of bleeding, we can't just get rid of the gzera of Shimsha Atu, lo Shimsha Atu Shimsha. We have to make it a situation where she is halachically forbidden to have relations, and then it's not a problem because that's the way the halacha works. How do we do that? By having their not tovel every other cycle. Okay? Because if a woman has not gone to the mikveh, and this is just true for plain practical halacha reasons, if a woman has not gone to the mikveh and starts to bleed while she is still nida, then she in fact does not have a 5-day minimum because there was no possibility at all halachically of having had relations, and therefore she could in fact be able to do that. That's a solution that was proposed by the Hartzvi. I will mention, though, the situation that he was talking about and he applied it was a woman who was having periods or becoming nida every 14 days. Okay? So to tell her every other cycle was not necessarily so bad. My guess is that she probably had ovulation bleeding, and that's what it was. So I'm kind of hoping he guessed which 14 days to tell her to skip, but it doesn't get into that in the tshuva. But in the Tzitz Eliezer, which is later, he uses that as an overall thing. So this is one of the debates that comes up halacha l'maase is, do we allow the couple to shorten it just by not having relations for a couple of days, or do we in fact require them not to have relations every other month, which is hard for any couple, and it's particularly hard for an infertile couple, which every single cycle is a potential lost time, and now we're telling them 50% of the time to lose it. There are two other approaches that are mentioned, one of which is a very long article by Rabbi Auerbach that was printed in Noam, where he reviews this entire topic in length, and anyone who wants to look at this seriously, I recommend they look at that in place, because one of the things he discusses is even possibly ways for the woman never to become nida in the first place. Because in order for a woman to become nida, the blood has to exit the uterus and end up in the vaginal canal. And if we were able to have it completely bypass the vaginal canal, she wouldn't become nida. So he talks about this concept of a shroferet and how to do it. This never developed practically because then we got to other medical solutions, but it's A, it's interesting theoretically, and B, it's worth keeping in the back of mind because an important principle of medicine is to realize it doesn't always work. Another important tshuva is that of Rav Avadya Yosef in Yabia Omer. It was actually asked in the context of should we allow this couple to have artificial insemination, which I'm going to get to soon, but he does discuss the possibility of using some of the things that he feels are okay, such as douching, okay, such as the four-day minimum, and things of that sort, as ways to be able to address this. Now, the ability to actually deal with this medically seems to have started around 1970. The earliest article that I've able to find so far in the medical literature was an article published in Hebrew in HaRefuah, where Dr. Tauf discusses a religious component of infertility and proposes estrogen as a solution. He actually describes their first attempt at doing it, in which they would give estrogen the entire time that she was bleeding. Estrogen, the way that estrogen works is basically what convinces the pituitary to secrete the follicle-stimulating ovulation, the FSH, that starts the follicle developing is just the right level of estrogen. So if we can trick the body by giving it exogenous estrogen, then it doesn't produce the FSH as long as the estrogen is there. We'll stop the estrogen, it'll start the process, but it'll start the process later in the cycle because we've fooled it. With me? The only problem with doing it that way is very often when you give estrogen and you stop doing estrogen, you get withdrawal bleeding. And therefore, we just made this woman nida the day she was ready to go to the mikveh, and it didn't work very well. They then decided, well, what would happen if we gave her the estrogen while she was nida anyway? Okay, just give it to her for the first 2-3 days of the cycle. And they discovered that, in fact, by giving it the first couple of days of the cycle, in most cases, that's enough to delay it past mikveh use. It'll delay it by 2-3 days. And since most women who have short cycles, it means day 10, it means day 11, so 2-3 more days can easily, in many cases, get us past the time that she goes to the mikveh. I guess because this was written in Hebrew, it kind of got lost in the medical literature for approximately 20 years. And the next time that you will see any discussion of dealing with halachic infertility is in a 1991 textbook. I'm going to get to that in a minute. And starting in 2005. This 1992 article that I mentioned by De Ziegler was actually showing that you could use estrogen, very much as Tauf said back in the 70s, to program ovulation. However, they weren't interested in so more for halachic infertility. They were just using it as an ability, the time, that you could be able to do, for example, intrauterine insemination, as we saw outlined this morning, for general fertility intervention. I'm willing to guess that a fair number of doctors saw that, said, this is going to help halachic infertility, and applied it, but no one actually wrote that up as a series or anything until 2005, where Dahana et al. Actually took a slightly different approach, that instead of giving just estrogen, they decided to give an oral contraceptive pill, which is a combination of estrogen and progesterone, and lo and behold, they showed that works also. Once again, it was given for approximately 2 days at the beginning of the cycle, and it was able to delay it. The theoretical advantage of having it combined with the progesterone is that the progesterone keeps the uterine lining a little bit thinner, so you're a little bit less likely to have the withdrawal bleeding, as this was done on a grand total of about 2 patients. I don't think we know a tremendous... It worked in those 2 patients. That's what I can tell you that. Okay? And in 2006, there was a slightly larger series of 26 patients showing that if you give, in this case, plain estrogen, you were actually able to delay it. Interesting thing that I think we have to keep in mind here, okay, it worked in 71% of the women. Okay? Now, that's good for 71% of the women, but it is important for us to realize that it doesn't always work. Okay, another solution that was proposed, this actually should be 1991, not 1999, in the textbook of Spiroff, suggested using clomiphene. Clomiphene is, at the level of the pituitary, an estrogen antagonist. In this case, we are fooling the pituitary by thinking that there isn't enough estrogen. So the body then says, okay, I have to do more FSH, more FSH. But there's a little bit of a time lag. And that little bit of a time lag can be just enough for that ovulation to take place after using the mikveh as opposed to before using the mikveh. The side effect of that, though, is since we are convincing the body to make more FSH, it tends to make more follicles, and there's about a 10% chance of twinning. And I think Dr. Grazi did a good point this morning of showing that we don't like twins. We like them when they're born, but we try to get them not to be an ideal situation. As a pediatrician who has worked in the NICU, I echo his feelings. And it has about a 1% chance of triplets. So if it has multiple births, it's usually twins, which are not as bad as triplets, but it does have this possibility of causing multiple births. I want to mention that with the exception of this, I have yet to find any other obstetric textbook, and I have a brother who's a reproductive endocrinologist, and I went through all his books just to check, that discusses the issue of halachic infertility. So it's important to realize, while this may seem so obvious to us and so common to us, it is not something that is known very well by the general medical community, and that's an issue to take into consideration when a couple is going for treatment. The doctor who's treating them may be very well trained, but have never really heard of this condition. Even if they've heard about it, they may not understand all the nuances that I hope you understand by the end of this lecture. Another potential solution is, okay, so the couple can have relations while she is nida, but maybe we can have the conception take place in the absence of relations, okay? At the time, this 1986 article was written, he was talking about artificial insemination. That was also the topic discussed by Rabbi Ovadia Yosef. But the exact same argument could be put to intrauterine insemination. Okay, today they would be the two things that you could possibly use. And anyone who wants to look into this, I recommend an article by Yosef Green, published in 1986 in Asia, where he really goes through every single issue involved in artificial insemination, which is could be a lecture in its own right, and applies it to here. Okay, now one of the reasons I chose this topic to discuss at this conference is because there has been, at least in Israel over the last year, a lot of tararam about the issue of halachic infertility. This tararam began with an article published in Hatzofe exactly a year ago, Parshat Lech Lecha, Tafshin Samech Zayin, whose title was Chumra de Rabbi Zera Ha'im Higia Zman Chashiva Mechudeshet. The Chumra of Rabbi Zera is a time for fresh thinking. Now, people who want to see this article, and if you're interested in the topic, I recommend seeing it, and can also then see all the responses that were printed to it in Hatzofe. They're all found on the Kolech website, www.kolech.org. This initial article was an interview with a Dr. Daniel Rosnak, a Frum gynecologist based in Jerusalem, mostly working with the Haredi population, and he raised five main points. One of which was that this is a very common condition. He feels that one quarter of his fertility patients have this condition. Second of all, it's only a minhag, and thus it can be changed. Who says you have to take medicine to keep a mitzvah? The medications being used are dangerous. And his conclusion in the article is pretty much, we should get rid of the Shivaniki. Now, as you can imagine, this created a bit of a stir. And I want to go through a number of his points based on some research that I have done. Probably because this was creating a stir in the lay literature, my chavrusa from the time I was learning in Nishmat Yoetzer Halacha program and myself applied for a grant from Bar Ilan to study the topic of halachic infertility. And we were, in fact, given a grant, and we were in the process of doing a number of studies to try to address some of his points and some other, what I feel are unanswered points in the literature so far. So as far as how many people actually suffer from this, the way that we're addressing this question is we are going to look at, so far, two practices of practicing general obstetricians and see how frequent halachic infertility is in the general obstetric practice. So far, we have managed to look at the records of one large practice. We went through, our research assistant, thank God for research grants, went through 2020 charts altogether that came to the clinic, found that 415 of them were there for fertility problems in general, which works in pretty well with the 20% infertility rate that they always quote in the medical literature. So that was good. Not surprisingly, the incidence, there's a general fertility problem so far, the incidence of this goes up with age. So of those women, we'll ignore those who are under 20, but of those women who are, let's say, 20 to 25, approximately 19% came in for a complaint of fertility, and by the time they were 36 to 40, it was up to 33% who were going in. It looks like it's going down again after 41, but that's probably more of a reflection of the fact that after that age, many women, even if they are not conceiving, are not necessarily trying to conceive. And that's why only 14% of the complaints are, not that all of a sudden fertility goes back up at 41. Okay, don't misinterpret this. But this trend, I think, is an important and not a surprising one. Okay, more important though, and this is previously unpublished data and I have not found anything else like it, it looks like things are actually worse than Dr. Rosenach said. This is the incidence in her clinic as far as what is the percentage of halachic infertility. If you're talking about young women, it's about a quarter, okay, 28%. However, if you go up to 31 to 35, you're up to almost 50%, you know, over 50% and almost 50%. So this looks like it also goes up with age. Not surprisingly, if we remember that the average menstrual cycle shrinks over time. So a woman who had, a 27-day menstrual cycle when she was younger, because she was on this side of the average, did okay when she was younger, and it got 2 days shorter, as it often does when she gets older, all of a sudden, she now has a problem with halachic infertility. Okay. Another one of his points is that it's only a minhag and thus can be changed. I hope I showed you in the sources that I talked to you easier that this is not just a minhag, this is actually a series of gezeirot. I think a fair discussion of that topic would need a session in its own right and also somebody even more trained in the development of halachic literature than I've been in my practice. Some of the issues have come up in the answers that you can see on the Kolech website. Okay, a number of Rabbanim answered as far as that. As far as his question, who said you have to take medicine to keep a mitzvah, I'd like to answer that we do surgery to keep the mitzvah of Brit Milah. So I'm not totally sure that I find that a good complaint. As far as the medications being dangerous, one of the things I really do give Dr. Rosenach credit for is raising a certain amount of consciousness among Rabbanim that these medications are not candy. Okay, both in this context and in the context of Sidur Veset Lekalot, where in the last issue of Asya, by the way, I published an article together with another gynecologist questioning the use of hormonal manipulating of every single girl who get married. I'm not saying never, but I wonder about always. There are side effects to these medications, okay? To discuss this in depth in itself would need a conference, but just to give you three recent articles showing that there is some basis to the fear, and this fear is often brought up on the part of women themselves, to the medications that they're used. If we look at clomiphene, there can be shown to be an increased rate of uterine cancer. there is an increased rate of breast cancer in a number of ovulation stimulation drugs. And perhaps the scariest study has been what happened in the study of hormone replacement therapy, because the estrogen that we are using for this purpose is the same estrogen that was being used for hormone replacement therapy. And there is a pretty convincing association between an increased risk of breast cancer. Now, this has to be put into context, because if you're talking about something whose incidence is 1 in 100,000, you increase it by 100%. It's 2 in 100,000. Okay? So these risks also have to be taken into context, and I think the degree of fear that he talks about in some of his lectures is a bit exaggerated, but I do think that there is enough basis in this fear of this medication to make us look once again at halachic interventions. And my biggest question is halachic infertility being diagnosed correctly? And I have a couple of reasons that I'm a little bit suspicious that it is not, one of which is in my work on the Yoetzot website. The Yoetzot website, and more information about it is available in the pamphlets if people want, is a website. We've had 6,500 questions to date. Among this, there were 88 questions about fertility. 48% were about halachic infertility, and in only one case did the person state they had already asked their rav about bedikot. Right? This complements my experience in real life when people ask me questions orally. So often, the women are assuming they're nida and have never bothered to find out if, in fact, they really were. We also have a hotline, 1-877-YOESTET. There, we've been computerizing that for about a year or so. There, I was able to find 15 cases of halachic infertility, once again, one of which had spoken to a rav before. Now, some people will say, no big deal. The women aren't asking, but the physicians are talking to the rabbanim, and we'll catch it at some point. Another study that we're in the process of doing, and if there are any gynecologists, by the way, here in the audience, I would be very happy to have this questionnaire filled out by a couple of American gynecologists, too. So if you want to contribute to this research and the greater good of science, please see me afterwards. But it's a question of five scenarios, how they would handle it. Of the 15 answers that I've gotten back so far, because we just started doing this about a month ago, so far we've done it in Israel, in what the doctor would do, given in a couple of scenarios having to do with what's probably halachic infertility, okay, she's already saying she keeps hilcho nida, she suspects she's Avdelin Bogos to go to the mikveh. Not a single one of the physicians had said, I would speak to her rav, I would tell her to speak to her rav, or anything of the sort. And that really, once again, I don't think this is just because they're not writing them the questionnaire. I think this really goes on a lot. And a personal discussion that I had with Rav Zachariah Ben Shlomo, who's the head of the Kol El Chalvim and also deals a lot with Hilchot Nida, he completely confirms this. I mean, he says, women called him up, tell me he has a 10-day period, and he knows he's going to get that down to somewhere between a 5 to 6 day period. Because a lot of what women think make them Nida does not, in fact, make them Nida. And part of that is, is understanding these caveats involved in Kilchot Ketamim. Okay? I said there was a rabbinic decree that you don't need Hagasha, but this rabbinic decree means, first of all, the bleeding has to be of a minimal size, about the size of a U.S. penny. It depends what surface it's found. Therefore, if it is found on something that is not Mekabel Tumah, and according to some halachic opinions, not Mekabel Tumah can include a sanitary napkin, it does not make her nida. If it is found on a colored surface, it does not make her nida. If it is found in a location that it probably did not come from the genital area, it does not make her nida. And if there is any other possible explanation, including the makah that we talked about earlier today, but even other explanations. Therefore, if you put those together, there actually are interventions that one can use to prevent a woman from becoming nida, including telling her to wear colored underwear, possibly telling her to wear sanitary napkins, if the rav goes by that opinion, and even using these interventions at times during the Shavah Nikiyah. Not as a general thing, but if we're talking about dealing with couples of infertility, it is much easier halachically to deal with those interventions than coming up with ideas like, let's get rid of the Sheva Nikiyim. And therefore, my proposed halachic intervention that should be considered in these cases is first and foremost to make sure she's really nida as long as she thinks she is by the women asking about the bidikot. If it's brown, ask. The chances are it's really going to be okay, especially if the Rav is aware that we're dealing with a fertility problem. To teach Rabbanim lenient traditions of colors, okay, because there are a number of traditions and it's also something that comes with practice. To use the caveats of Hilchot Ketamim, artificial insemination is a potential backup, and therefore, in most cases, there wouldn't be a need to get rid of the Sheva Nikiyim. Thank you. And now we have time for questions.
1 second. Hi, second. For recording purposes, we're making interactive DVDs, so just if you have a question, I will bring you the mic and just speak into the mic.
When you talk about using artificial insemination or intrauterine insemination mm-hmm. during the Sheva Nikiyim, mm-hmm. potentially during the Sheva Nikiyim, mm-hmm. let's say if she ovulates before, mm-hmm. Wouldn't that also cause a problem of her then having semen in her and then being able to count the rest of her Sheva Nikiyim? Because a lot of times the instructions that are given is, you know, let's say they do the IUI and then they say, okay, go home and have relations, you know, so that how can she continue to count her Sheva Nikiyim if she has semen within her?
Okay, so if she is having it done at the time that she is nida, she's not going home and having relations regardless because she's so nida. It will make a difference in terms of the Sheva Nikiyim that she may be going to the mikvah later that month. Okay? But generally, depending on the timing, 2 days later, 3 days later, you know, notice I don't put it as one of the higher possible interventions for a number of reasons. First of all, artificial insemination raises a number of halachic issues in its own right. The issue of procurement, the issue of all kinds of things, made even harder that we cannot be using the wife to aid in procurement because she's nida, okay? But it's it is another possibility. And if you want to, like I said, read more about it, I really suggest Yosef Green. It goes on and on, and I think he covered everything about it you could possibly want to know. Yes? In the back. Oh, sorry, I took the mic.
You mentioned douching at that to us medical field that do
that help. Okay, so first of all, douching is frowned upon medically, not so much for causing infertility generally, is more in terms of producing irritation and local inflammation that I guess if I go far enough I could come up with some reason that would also cause infertility, but it's more from a kind of thing. It's not a solution that most poskim will go by. I just mention it because Rav Ovadia does mention it, and based on a number of halachic sources that would indicate that there is at least the halachic possibility of doing it. One of the things to realize is that a medical definition, a halachic definition, don't always have to be exactly the same.
Thank you very much.
Okay. If anyone has any other questions that they were too embarrassed to ask in public, I will be standing here for the next 10 or 15 minutes, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Just everyone, we're starting the next session promptly at 3:30, and it's in Lamport Auditorium. There will be refreshments right outside. So if you can make your way towards there when you're finished, that would be great. Thank you so much, Dr. Zimmer, for coming. We really appreciate it, and thanks for being here.